A Sunday school class was studying this story in the Gospel of Matthew, and as part of the lesson, the teacher asked each of the children to draw a picture. But there was one picture that sort of confused the teacher, and she had to ask the student what it was that he was trying to draw. All she could make out was Mary and Joseph and Jesus, and then a small black dot next to them. So the teacher asked the student what that dot was supposed to be. And the student said, "Well, that's the flea. He was in the story you told us. You said that God told Joseph to hurry up and take Mary, Jesus, and flea to Egypt." Another Sunday school teacher, when the teacher asked the students to draw a picture of the story, one of the students depicted the scene with an airplane full of people. And when the teacher asked the child why she had drawn the story in that particular way, she answered, "Well, you said that today's story was about the flight to Egypt." And in the back part of the plane, the teacher could see Mary, Joseph, and Jesus, right? And so then the teacher asked, "Well, who's driving the airplane? Who's flying the plane?" And this kid said, "Well, that's Pontius, the pilot. You know, we talk about him every Sunday in the Apostles' Creed." I love these stories because they reveal such innocence. The innocence of children unable to comprehend the harsh reality of a violent world. It is hard to comprehend, really. It's hard to imagine someone like Herod willing to kill innocent children for the sake of personal power. But believe it, we must, because it is the world that we live in. Nobody wants to read this story right after Christmas when we're all still wrapped in the warm blanket of holiday cheer. But read it we must, for it reminds us of the truth. Jesus was not born into a Hallmark world of happy families exchanging gifts. Jesus was born into a brutal world that had gone very far astray of God's purposes. It was that world that God so loved that God sent his son, Jesus. It was that world into which Jesus came to work and to teach and ultimately to die. Matthew's lesson reminds us that even in the Christmas season, we are still surrounded by evil and violence and injustice. Even as we celebrate the birth of the Christ child, other children are dying. As Christians, we are called to see that reality clearly and to hold the vision of peace as one holds a candle in a dark room. The Gospel of Matthew was written for a community of early Christians that were deeply alienated from the culture in which they lived, the dominant culture and their government. They were followers of Jesus, and as such, their theology and lifestyle was in sharp contrast to the teachings of the Roman Empire. Imperial theology supported a system of domination and exploitation. They taught that the emperor ruled by the will of God. The early Christians believed that the will of God was revealed through Christ, not the emperor. In trying to be faithful to the teachings of Christ, they lived a countercultural, alternative existence in the midst of a world dominated by Rome. They were not trying to overthrow the Roman Empire. That would have been absurd. But they would not embrace its values and its practices. Is this description feeling oddly familiar to anyone? For a very long time, mainstream Christians in America, we thought ourselves to be the dominant culture. Many of us are now shocked to find ourselves living in America that we don't recognize, feeling deeply alienated from our government and the values and practices being promoted by the powers that be. In many ways, we are closer now to the early Christians than we have been in years. And so we have much to learn from the gospel according to Matthew. According to Matthew, when Joseph dreamed that the king wanted to kill his son, he didn't shake it off with a comment like, "Well, that's just a dream." He did not respond with naive, good-hearted innocence. No. He got up, left his job, his family, his friends, his country, and everything he knew in order to protect the most precious thing of all, his blessed son. He did that because he knew the truth about Herod. He knew just how hateful hate can be. He knew just how much power can corrupt a soul. He knew the lengths to which some people will go when they feel threatened. And because he knew the truth, he and his tiny family became refugees. I can't read this story without thinking of the tens of thousands of children and families that are amassed on our border asking for nothing but safety and a chance to live like Jesus to adulthood. The Bible story does not tell us much about the journey to Egypt, but we can flesh it out. We know that they did not, in fact, book a flight to Egypt. They walked or rode on donkeys. The families coming from South America or Latin America are walking or riding on buses. Joseph did not put their life savings into a password-protected bank account and pay for things with a debit card. They carried everything they owned with them, and as such, they were vulnerable to robbery and thieves. So are the children, the women, and the men trying to make it to America. I think most of you probably know that one of the problems for women is they get kidnapped into being trafficked. The Bible story does not tell us where they ate or where they slept. Hotels were few and far between in those parts. So how many peasant farmers took them in for a night or two, provided shelter, safety, a bit of food, packed a little bit of food for them to take on their next leg of the journey? There must have been quite a number of generous souls quietly helping Jesus' little family on their way. Who were helping the families from South America? In biblical times, hospitality was a sacred obligation. Today, when we hear the word hospitality, we're likely to think of inviting some friends over and setting a nice dinner and, you know, lighting some candles and providing a good meal. But in those days, hospitality meant a great deal more. Traveling was dangerous. Finding safe shelter could be the difference between life and death. Everybody knew this. So providing hospitality to strangers was a moral responsibility. And so the peasants did it as a matter of course. The story does not tell us either who it was in Egypt that took a chance on a foreigner and gave Joseph a job. Someone must have, because he and his family survived. So Jesus did live to adulthood. Is there anything sounding a little bit familiar? Anything you might have seen in the news lately? There are millions of people doing exactly what Joseph did, fleeing their homeland to protect their children and hoping to keep them alive. I do not have to tell you that we are right now in the middle of a worldwide immigration crisis. And the question is, what will our response be? I know I don't want to sit this one out. But by myself, I feel powerless. So I look to my church. Churches are the perfect vehicle to respond to a crisis like this. We have people, a building to meet in, resources, expertise, organization, and a calling from Christ. All we really need is focus and commitment. As you all know, in September, we went through a discernment process to determine 4 projects or programs to focus on for the next year or two. And one of the ones that you selected as a congregation was immigrant support in partnership with the Marin Interfaith Council. Annie Songhill has been attending the meetings of the Marin Interfaith Council and reporting back to us. And in 2 weeks, you will vote on a proposal to declare First Congregational Church an immigrant accompaniment congregation. And I really hope that you will all read the material that is in your current copy of the newsletter, The Tie. Accompaniment is defined as providing support to families who have a loved one who is detained or in the process of being deported. The belief is the legal status of the family member detained or deported has no bearing on our compassionate ministry to help ensure that their loved ones have food, clothing, shelter, transportation, and spiritual support. Now, I can't tell you how to vote on this proposal, but I can share with you some of my experiences. I know that when a person is incarcerated for any reason, it puts tremendous stress on their family. I learned this because in another church I served, one of my parishioners was incarcerated. He wasn't an immigrant. He was an American citizen. He did something he shouldn't have done, and he got jail time. I didn't condone what he had done, but he was among my parishioners, so I went to visit him in jail. I don't know much about the prison system, but it didn't look to me to be a real high-security jail. I went and visited him, and he said something to me that I've never forgotten. He said, "You know what? It's really not that bad in here." Said, "I've got a warm place to sleep, 3 meals a day. They've got a library. I can get books. They have some 12-step meetings we can attend. They have worship on Sunday. It's not that bad. The one that is suffering is my wife, because she's out there struggling with the pressure of trying to hold together our family and our life." He said if they really wanted to punish us, they would take our wives and children and put them in here and provide them with shelter and food and make us go out there and deal with the stress of holding together a life that is falling apart. I said, "Whoa, I had never even thought about it." I thought, "Well, maybe I need to go pay a pastoral call on his wife." So I called her, and it took me a while to schedule an appointment because she was so busy. But we found an hour to sit down and talk, and I got to tell you, she was a mess. She was a basket case. They still had children at home. Like many families, they had managed to buy a house, but it was predicated on 2 full-time incomes. Suddenly, her husband had no income. So she was struggling to try to make the payments, working, picking up work wherever she could to try to make the payments, keep food on the table, take the kids to and from school, try to be some kind of parent to her children while struggling with all this stress. And she was losing the battle. The bank, she wasn't being able to make the payments. The bank was threatening foreclosure. She was trying to renegotiate the loan. And what is she supposed to write on this loan application? How is she supposed to explain that they now have half the income they once had? "But it'll be okay when my husband gets out of jail." How's that going to look on a loan application? So she was struggling with all of that. If she lost the house, they would lose whatever equity they had in it. She would be the one to have to find some place to rent, figure out how to write a rental application, pack up the whole family, move, all of that by herself. She was under a lot of stress. No good can come from a family lapsing into homelessness. No good can come from a family having to go on food stamps. No good can come from a woman working so hard that she can't pay attention to her children. No good comes from a wife being so stressed that she develops mental illness, anxiety disorder, depression. None of that is good for our society or our communities. I share this story just to tell you that when a person is incarcerated for whatever reason, their family needs support. I heard a chilling statistic the other day. I was told that we now have more prisons in our country than colleges. I have to ask, is it really necessary to have so many people in jail? I've also heard that the violent crime rate in our country has been steadily dropping for 25 years. So those two statistics are not adding up for me. I think we can do better. I do want to share with you another story, and this is a story about an immigrant family. A church that I previously served decided to become an accompaniment congregation, and they made the decision to accompany one family. And this is their story as it was told to me, as I understand it. This was a small family, a mother, a father, a child. Both of the parents had, years ago, crossed the border without visas. He was 16 when he crossed the border, and he quickly got a job with a construction company and has been working ever since. He's now about 40 years old. They got married here. Their child was born here, which makes that child an American citizen. At some point in those years, and I don't know when, he made the mistake of getting behind the wheel of a car after drinking. He was pulled over, got a DUI. For those of you that don't know what that means, it means driving under the influence. So that's on his record. ICE, which stands for Immigration and Custom Enforcement, was tapping through their computer files, and they saw the DUI on the record and decided that he could be deported. And so they arrested him. He then spent 2 years in West County detention. Apparently, the immigration laws are not so clear that he could be quickly deported. And so instead, he sat in jail. And for 2 years, his son was without a father and developed traumatic stress syndrome. His wife struggled in limbo for 2 years, trying to pay the rent, make ends meet, take care of their child, without his income. And we, the taxpayers, spent $142,000 to keep him in jail for 2 years. What's wrong with this picture? I don't know about you, but I can personally think of more constructive ways to spend $142,000. His wife came into contact with the Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity. The executive director of that organization will be here next Sunday to talk. I hope all of you will come and hear her. She put the wife in touch with a good immigration attorney and also in touch with this church that agreed to accompany this family. The church supported them in a number of ways. They attended his hearings. They tutored the child and taught him, began teaching him English and trying to help him get ready to go to school. He was a preschooler. And they supported the wife in whatever ways they could. The attorney was able to get him out of the detention center. His employer posted $32,000 in bail because he values him so much as an employee and trusts him. So he was then put back to work, supporting his family, contributing to society while his deportation case was winding its way through the legal system. ICE figured out a year ago that his attorney was planning to take a vacation over Christmas and spend Christmas in Hawaii. So a couple of days before Christmas, they waited at his house. When he came home from work, they handcuffed him and put him on a bus to Mexico. They tried to arrest his wife, but she knew that they had no legal right to enter her house without a warrant, and they didn't have a warrant. And so she refused to open the door, which is her legal right. She contacted the church. The church was able to track down his attorney in Hawaii, who had to interrupt her vacation to get him pulled off of that bus and brought back home. He now has a work permit, is working steadily, supporting his family, and his deportation case is still pending. So we don't know what's going to happen. I do not know his address, but I do know the neighborhood that he lives in, and it's about 10 minutes from my house. And I have to say that I in no way, shape, or form feel that my security is threatened by the fact that he lives 10 minutes from me. As a taxpayer, I see no reason to spend my hard-earned money locking up people who are not a threat to my security. When I look at this whole picture, what I see is that there are people making a lot of money building, filling, and staffing prisons and jails. It has become a major industry in our country. And the product is prisoners and destroyed lives. And you and I, the taxpayers, are paying for it. And again, I can think of much better industries that we could be investing our money in, like maybe electric vehicles, for instance, planting more trees, I don't know. I realize that the immigration crisis is complex and it is confusing. I believe that a country has a right to protect its borders and vet the people that come in. I do believe that. I think that the root causes for the immigration crisis are many and they are varied. And I think that every refugee, asylum seeker, undocumented worker, and immigrant has his or her own unique story. I don't think there are any simple answers. I don't think it's black and white. And I personally don't know how to fix it. Our world leaders, our politicians, our public servants, our judges, our attorneys are called to make and to enforce policies and laws. And I pray that God give them wisdom and guidance as they do their work. But in the meantime, I live by a few very simple truths. One of the simple truths that I try to live by is one that my southern mama taught me. You can catch more flies with honey than with vinegar. When we treat a person with kindness, we make a friend. When we treat a person with cruelty or oppression, we make an enemy. No good can come from a child being traumatized. That little boy I told you about, every time the doorbell rings, he runs and hides under the table. It's just going to cause more problems for everyone later on. No good can come from a woman being so stressed that she develops debilitating anxiety or depression that negatively affects her ability to work, earn a living, and care for her children. It just causes more problems for everyone later on. No good can come from a productive man being locked up unnecessarily. I cannot fix the immigration crisis, but I might be able to treat someone with kindness, ease the burden of a stressed mother, help someone access their legal rights, or even save a life that's in danger. Our Christian story tells us that Jesus was a refugee in need of help. I like to think that I would have helped him. Amen. I've asked a few people to come forward and read for us a Christmas creed written in Latin America. It is printed in your bulletin, and so I would like to ask those people to come up here now. You can follow along in your bulletin. Michael Chan.
I believe in Jesus Christ and in the power of the gospel which began in Bethlehem.
I believe in the one whose spirit glorified a small village, of whose coming the shepherds saw the sign, and for whom there was no room at the inn.
I believe in the one whose life changed the course of history, for whom the kings of the earth had no power, and who was not understood by the proud.
I believe in the one to whom the poor, the oppressed, the discouraged, the afflicted, the sick, the blind, and the leprous gave welcome and accept as Lord and Savior.
I believe in the one who loved changed the heart of the proud and with his life showed that it is more important to serve than to be served, and that the greatest joy is giving your life for others.
I believe in peace, which is not the absence of war, but justice among all people and nations, and love among all.
I believe in reconciliation, forgiveness, and the transforming power of the gospel.
I believe that Christmas is strength and power, and that this world can change if with humility and faith we kneel before the manger.
I believe that I must be the first one to do so. Thank you. And now I would invite you all to be in a moment of silence.